and the second was a great raid of the Gauls from the north into Italy. These latter people swarmed into North Italy and occupied the valley of the Po towards the end of the 5th century BC, as a couple of centuries later their kindred were to swarm down into Greece and Asia Minor and settle in Galatia. The Etruscans were thus caught between hammer and anvil, and after a long and intermittent war the Romans were able to capture Veii, an Etruscan fortress, a few miles from Rome, which had hitherto been a great threat and annoyance to them. It's to this period of struggle against the Etruscan monarchs, the Tarquins, that Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome, familiar to every schoolboy, refer. But the invasion of the Gauls was one of those convulsions of the nations that leave nothing as it has been before. They carried their raiding right down the Italian peninsula, devastating all Etruria. They took and sacked Rome, 390 BC. According to Roman legends, on which doubt is thrown, the citadel on the capital held out, and this also the Gauls would have taken by surprise at night if certain geese hadn't been awakened by their stealthy movements and set up such a cackling as to arouse the garrison. After that, the Gauls, who were ill-equipped for siege operations and perhaps suffering from disease in their camp, were bought off and departed to the northward again, and though they made subsequent raids, they never again reached Rome. The leader of the Gauls who sacked Rome was named Brennus. It's related of him that as the gold of the ransom was being weighed, there was some dispute about the justice of the counterpoise, whereupon he flung his sword into the scale, saying, "Vae victis, woe to the vanquished," a phrase that has haunted the discussions of all subsequent ransoms and indemnities down to the present time. For half a century after this experience, Rome was engaged in a series of wars to establish herself at the head of the Latin tribes, for the burning of the chief cities seems to have stimulated rather than crippled her energies. However much she had suffered, most of her neighbours seemed to have suffered more. By 290 BC, Rome was the mistress city of all central Italy, from the Arno to south of Naples. She'd conquered the Etruscans altogether, and her boundaries marched with those of the Gauls to the north, and with the regions of Italy under Greek dominion, Magna Graecia, to the south. Along the Gaulish boundary she had planted garrisons and colonial cities, and no doubt it was because of that line of defence that the raiding enterprises of the Gauls were deflected eastward into the Balkans. After what we've already told of the history of Greece and the constitutions of her cities, it'll not surprise the reader to learn that the Greeks of Sicily and Italy were divided up into a number of separate city governments, of which Syracuse and Tarentum, the modern Taranto, were the chief, and that they had no common rule of direction or policy. But now, alarmed at the spread of the Roman power, they looked across the Adriatic for help and found it in the ambitions of Pyrrhus, the king of Epirus. Between the Romans and Pyrrhus, these Greeks of Magna Graecia were very much in the same position that Greece proper had been in between the Macedonians and the Persians half a century before. The reader will remember that Epirus, the part of Greece that's closest to the heel of Italy, was the native land of Olympias, the mother of Alexander. In the kaleidoscopic changes of the map that followed the death of Alexander, Epirus was sometimes swamped by Macedonia, sometimes independent. This Pyrrhus was a kinsman of Alexander the Great, and a monarch of ability and enterprise, and he seems to have planned a career of conquest in Italy and Sicily. He commanded an admirable army against which the comparatively inexpert Roman levies could at first do little. His army included all the established military devices of the time, an infantry phalanx, Thessalian cavalry, and 20 fighting elephants from the east. He routed the Romans at Heracles in 280 BC, and pressing after them, defeated them again at Asculum in 279 BC, in their own territory. Then, instead of pursuing the Romans further, he made a truce with them, turning his attention to the subjugation of Sicily, and so brought the sea power of Carthage into alliance against him. For Carthage couldn't afford to have a strong power established so close to her as Sicily. Rome in those days seemed to the Carthaginians a far less serious threat than the possibility of another Alexander the Great ruling Sicily. A Carthaginian fleet appeared off the mouth of the Tiber, therefore, to encourage or induce the Romans to renew the struggle, and Rome and Carthage were definitely allied against the invader. This interposition of Carthage was fatal to Pyrrhus. Without any decisive battle, his power wilted, and after a disastrous repulse in an attack upon the Roman camp of Beneventum, he had to retire to Epirus in 275 BC. It's recorded that when Pyrrhus left Sicily, he said he left it to be the battleground of Rome and Carthage. He was killed 3 years later in a battle in the streets of Argos. The war against Pyrrhus was won by the Carthaginian fleet, and Rome reaped a full half of the harvest of victory. Sicily fell completely to Carthage, and Rome came down to the toe and heel of Italy and looked across the Straits of Messina at her new rival. In 11 years' time, 264 BC, the prophecy of Pyrrhus was fulfilled, and the first war with Carthage, the first of the three Punic Wars, had begun. Second. But we write Rome and the Romans, and we have still to explain what manner of people these were who were playing a role of conquest that had hitherto been played only by able and aggressive monarchs. Their state was, in the 5th century BC, a republic of the Arian type, very similar to a Greek aristocratic republic. The earliest accounts of the social life of Rome give us a picture of a very primitive Arian community. In the second half of the 5th century before Christ, Rome was still an aristocratic community of free peasants occupying an area of nearly 400 square miles, with a population certainly not exceeding 150,000, almost entirely dispersed over the countryside and divided into 17 districts or rural tribes. Most of the families had a small holding and a cottage of their own, where father and sons lived and worked together, growing corn for the most part, with here and there a strip of vine or olive. Their few head of cattle were kept at pasture on the neighboring common land. Their clothes and simple implements of husbandry they made for themselves at home. Only at rare intervals and on special occasions would they make their way into the fortified town, which was the center at once of their religion and their government. Here were the temples of the gods, the houses of the wealthy, and the shops of the artisans and traders, where corn, oil, or wine could be bartered in small quantities for salt or rough tools and weapons of iron. This community followed the usual tradition of a division into aristocratic and common citizens, who were called in Rome patricians and plebeians. These were the citizens. The slave or outlander had no more part in the state than he had in Greece. But the constitution differed from any Greek constitution in the fact that a great part of the ruling power was gathered into the hands of a body called the Senate, which was neither purely a body of hereditary members, nor directly an elected and representative one. It was a nominated one, and in the earlier period it was nominated solely from among the patricians. It existed before the expulsion of the kings, and in the time of the kings it was the king who nominated the senators. But after the expulsion of the kings in 510 BC, the supreme government was vested in the hands of two elected rulers, the consuls, and it was the consuls who took over the business of appointing senators. In the early days of the Republic, only patricians were eligible as consuls or senators, and the share of the plebeians in the government consisted merely in a right to vote for the consuls and other public officials. Even for that purpose, their votes didn't have the same value as those of their patrician fellow citizens. But their votes had at any rate sufficient weight to induce many of the patrician candidates to profess a more or less sincere concern for plebeian grievances.